Hello.
Hello.
All manner of.
Wave the phone at the wife.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Fine.
Did something go wrong?
No. It's fine. So, Alan, we invited you on specifically to talk about bug reporting after our little conversation on the IRC a few weeks ago. Do you want to do that bit first?
I'm easy. If you don't mind me lingering like a bad smell, then I will hang around. But if you want me to get off and not invade your podcast, then I will
No,
have to do
that's
one
fine.
segment and then go away.
I keep banging on about never having any proper guests apart from the pre-recorded interviews, so the more the merrier, because it means I get less to do, really.
Yeah, super, no problem.
You have to make sure you swear all the time as well, just to balance out Robin not having as much to
No. I have the monopoly on swearing
do.
usually.
So if I just say now, f*** partridge or something like that, then you can slot that in anywhere along the line you like.
It makes it easy. I mean, you have to surreptitiously insert them as you're speaking, just normally.
I'm starting to wonder if this was a good idea, actually.
Full Circle Podcast, Episode 7, for Wednesday, May 19th, 2010. Two tin cans and a length of string. In this episode, UDS, bugs, and a humble bundle.
Hello, world, and welcome to episode 7 of the Full Circle Podcast. Good evening, everybody. For the first time, it's a proper evening recording, so in theory, we should all be awake by now, especially Dave. With me, I have, as per usual, Mr. Dave Wilkins.
Good evening.
Mr. Ed Hewitt.
Evening.
And by special invitation, Mr. Alan Pope.
Hello, how are you doing?
We're good, thank you. Trying to keep it all together, as per usual. We invited Alan on to talk about bug reporting, the bug reporting process that Ed was getting a little disgruntled with a few weeks ago, so I thought we'd get somebody on who could give us chapter and verse on the right way of going about filing bug reports and what should then happen from there on. We'll talk about that in a moment after we do our first segment. Ed, what have you been doing since last episode?
I've created a wiki page for the podcast now, which is attached to the Full Circle Magazine wiki page, which is on the Ubuntu wiki. The URL will be in the show notes, and it just basically has a bit about the podcast, the hosts, how to get in contact with us, as well as all the show notes for all the episodes so far.
Very good. So if anybody out there has got any other ideas of what they'd like us to put on the wiki page, do let us know. We'll put our thinking caps on and see if we can't add a bit more value to that as well. What else has been going on with you then, Ed?
I've also bought a new monitor to replace my old 15-inch. It's a Acer X203H from Currys, which is a 20-inch widescreen monitor. The bug report I was complaining about a few weeks ago is now irrelevant because I've solved the problem by getting a new monitor.
That's rather an expensive way of dealing with a bug.
It is, but it's fixed.
Very good.
I've also had some fun with one of the new Lucid features, which is the ability to sync your iPod with Ubuntu via Rhythmbox, and it worked very well, so I don't have to use iTunes anymore.
Very good.
That's did see all, that. Quite interesting.
Yes.
Good.
And it works with the iPhone, doesn't it, as well? The latest iPhone works at the moment. I don't know if Apple are going to patch it to block out support for third-party applications.
Probably.
But I expect it will be.
Well, that wouldn't surprise anybody, would it? Okay, I've actually been quite busy as well since the last time. I've been upgrading and installing things. I've upgraded the Dell and the JVC to Lucid using the upgrade option, which all worked absolutely fine, very smooth, and so both of those machines are up to spec and working. I've upgraded the Compaq Evo to the final release of 10.04 Lubuntu, which is also working fine. And because I had some extra space on the hard drive, I did a bit of repartitioning, and the Compact now is a dual boot machine with Linux Mint 9, which is currently on the release candidate. I'll give it a couple of days before I put the Mint 9 final release on there, just to make sure they've got a stable release out. I've started playing around with Mint again. I seem to skip over all the odd-numbered releases. I think I've played with 5, 7, and now 9. Not deliberately, that's just the way it's worked out. So I've been doing a few review pieces on that for the blog. I wrote a critique of the Ubuntu manual, their first draft of Getting Started, and had some more conversations with Benjamin and with Kevin Godby about what they're going to do with the manual, and they've preempted most of my criticism, because I just struck out with all the blindingly obvious things that I could think of, having written a few software manuals in the past, and they've headed me off at the pass. Between the features they've got coming up on the Ubuntu Learning Center and the lessons that they've taken from the first edition, they're getting on and implementing most of the points that I raised, so should be good to see the next couple of versions of that manual. And the other thing that I've done, which we're hoping to put in a few segments in this and later episodes, I grabbed the audio of Mr. Mark Shuttleworth's keynote speech from UDS, because he had some quite interesting things to say about future releases. If Mr. Pope doesn't mind over there, I've ripped the audio from the video that he took.
was it good enough for that, was it?
It's good enough to fit in with the rubbish that we do. I don't think any of the audio files out there will be particularly impressed by the time I've mashed it up, but it was perfectly understandable. I listened to it while I was doing a few other things, and a bit of audio only. If I can find some way of getting hold of Mark's slides, that would be good. That could go on the wiki if anybody knows where to get them.
There is an org version of the video taken by the professional video guys.
Right.
I'll give you a link to that. You can put it in your show notes, because it's also got video, all the other videos, because a lot of people complained. Well, not a lot. I think two people complained that it was in Flash format, the videos that went online. So there's org Theora versions as well. So I'll give you a link to those as well.
Apart from that, I somehow managed to fit in a trip to Devon and back. Yeah, this is why I don't know what day I'm on anymore. Dave, what have you been up to?
Ah, look at you. Travelling all through those time zones and things.
I know, Devon's somewhere in the 19th century.
Right? Well, basically, the past couple of weeks, I've been playing with my lovely new Nexus One phone, which is very nice. I intend to do a review of that perhaps next week. Also, Ed pointed me in the direction of the Humble Indie Bundle, which has taken up a lot of my gaming time, especially with World of Goo, which Ed has reviewed in the latest Full Circle magazine. And I'm very impressed with this whole bundle as a whole, actually. Penumbra, very scary. It's not a great time for horror games generally, but the indie market doesn't seem to follow traditional the commercial games market. Also, I'm now using Lucid. And a little upgraded Vine, and I'm quite impressed. Are we going to be talking about Lucid later on? If so, I can bring it up then.
I'm sure we can find time to talk about Lucid later on.
Jolly good. Okay, well, I'm now using Lucid, and it's still nice and good.
Shall we do the news?
Why not?
Full Circle News.
So, first story, Ubuntu UDS kicks off, and has indeed not only kicked off, but has been run and finished, and everybody's come home again. Ed?
Well, the first bit of news was prior to UDS kicking off, and Mark confirmed that there'll be no GNOME Shell or Blu-ray support in what's it called, Meerkat?
Maverick.
But Maverick, yes.
I'm still disappointed they're not using my title. What's wrong with Mental Mongoose?
Lucid Torvilles, that's a far better one, I think. Right, and also Nautilus Elementary, which is a redesign of Nautilus, may be used in 10.10 as well. Have you all seen that?
Is that the lightweight Nautilus that has a kind of very lean toolbar?
Yes, they've shrunk down the top of the Nautilus window, and have also put a zoom in, dragging arrow thing in the bottom right.
Oh, I already have that, it appears. Oh. I just opened Nautilus and found you're describing my Nautilus window.
So
I mean, Ed, what are you saying last weekend how much you liked breadcrumbs? And does oh no, they're there. Never mind. Carry on.
Next story.
I don't know if you were better at describing this, Popey, but were you at the desktop, deciding what will be in the desktop this year. That
which applications would be in the desktop?
Yes.
I wasn't at that session. No, tell me about it.
Right. So they decided what applications will be going into 10.10. And they've decided to remove F-Spot and replace it with Shotwell, which is a photo managing application designed by some Google developers and looks very nice. And I know it's in the latest version of Fedora, isn't it? Shotwell.
Yeah, I believe so.
That basically will get rid of F-Spot, which is a mono-based application. And they then went on to decide if they're going to get rid of Gbrainy as well as Tomboy, since they would be the only mono apps left into Ubuntu, which would save 25 meg on the disk. But they're going to leave those in, which I still think they could have replaced Gnote with
Tomboy. I thought the jury was still out on that one because of the notion of not just saving the disk space, but ditching the mandatory presence of anything mono.
I spoke to Rick Spencer about this, who does the desktop engineering, and he said the removal of F-Spot has absolutely nothing to do with it being mono. It's about choosing the right application for users, choosing the best application for the users of the desktop. And on the subject of Tomboy, it's difficult to get rid of Tomboy and replace it with Gnote because you actually lose functionality when you switch from Tomboy to Gnote. For example, the Ubuntu One note synchronization isn't available in Gnote, but it is in Tomboy. And I personally use that all day, every day. So I would miss that. But obviously, all of these applications that get replaced in various releases on the live CD, they're all still in the repository. So it's not like, you know, you can't install them. You could still have F-Spot if you want to. And if you already use F-Spot, you can continue to use F-Spot. But on new installs, you'll get Shotwell.
I've got to say, since I got Lucid on the other two machines, I have tried using F-Spot, and I still don't think it's really up to snuff.
Really? What are you saying is the problem with it?
I wanted to do something really simple like crop some photos the other day, and I was just finding F-Spot not a particularly great thing to use. So I went back to GIMP.
I actually gave my mum a PC recently, and I gave her Picasa. I just made the decision that she would use Picasa because it looked quite good and seemed to work. And she's been cropping photos, and she's never used a computer before. So, you know, if she can use it, that's my measure. If my mum can use it, then it must be good.
See, I'm different. I've stopped using GIMP now. I'm using F-Spot to do all my cropping because if you just open the picture in Ive GNOME, there's a simple button which says Edit Image, and that will open the edit functionality of F-Spot. So
yeah,
that works fine.
That was the rationale behind removing GIMP in Lucid. And I know a lot of people complained, and some people were very annoyed at the fact that we removed GIMP because, you know, there's no proper photo editor on the CD. But the fact is that your average user, the main thing they do is stuff like remove red eye, crop a photo, you know, the real, really basic stuff. And F-Spot can do that.
Yeah, so I'm not arguing with the decision to take out GIMP because it is a bit like using a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier to go fishing, but F-Spot just wasn't cutting it. And I had a quick look over what Shotwell does, and that looks like it could fill that function quite nicely.
Yeah, groovy.
It reminds me of iPhoto, so there's another Mac app for you.
Before we turn this into the Mac assassination show again, next story.
This was during Mark's keynote presentation where he talked about he wanted to work more with OEMs at getting Ubuntu installed by default and trying to improve the whole OEM process, as well as improve first boot experience, as well as media and codec handling. And I think that's all ties into Ubuntu Unite.
Yep. Lite. L-I-G-H-T.
Oh, is it two different things?
Ubuntu Lite is the version for OEMs.
Right.
Maybe the soundtrack on that video wasn't good enough then.
it's Ubuntu Lite, which is aimed at OEMs. Well, you know, that's one of the big problems, is trying to get OEMs to ship Ubuntu out of the box. And this is one of the things that this addresses, is it boots in 7 seconds to a web browser, and you can get online very nice and quickly and easily, and it's a pleasant user interface and all that lovely stuff.
But I thought that's what Unite did. What is?
Do you mean Unity?
Unity. Oh, sorry, I'm going to say.
Unity is the interface. The interface that will be used on Netbook Remix, I believe. Lite is effectively a distribution, but it's a distribution you won't be able to download. So there won't be an ISO image. So you won't be able to download an ISO image of Ubuntu Lite. It will be something that Canonical will give to OEMs, and if you buy a new PC, you'll get it on some new PCs from certain OEM vendors.
It's the ghost of Splashtop, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of. Splashtop is awful. Have you ever tried it?
I've seen it running once, and it was a bit Fisher Price.
It's a bit, yeah, okay. It's a nice and quick way to get to a browser, Skype, chat, and all that kind of stuff. But you know, it's not very pleasant.
As an experience, no.
It'd be nice if we could replace that with Ubuntu.
But won't Ubuntu Lite replace Windows? I thought it's going to be, you know, have Windows and Ubuntu Lite on the same machine.
It could do, yes. I mean, it depends on the OEMs, because they get to make the decision of what ship on their hardware. But Ubuntu Lite has no local storage. It's designed to be used with the cloud.
Right. But don't you think it'd be better if we marketed the Ubuntu desktop rather than many different looks of Ubuntu?
Yeah, we're doing that as well. So the problem is it's very hard to supplant Windows as the dominant operating system that gets shipped by OEMs. It's incredibly hard. And even though Ubuntu is certified on, you know, for example, take Dell, for example, it's certified on basically every Dell machine. The head of each region can pick and choose which machines they choose to sell.
Yeah.
And so even though we know it works and we know there are users out there who want it because they tell us that, it's up to someone inside an OEM to decide whether they're going to ship that or not. And that's the problem we have. We need to make a compelling thing for them to sell.
Right. Okay.
Difficult. Very difficult.
I think Mark's got his eye on that space that Splashtop was supposed to sit in, that if we can get something that's light enough, small enough, and fast enough, people will start to choose light over booting into Windows. If all they're looking for is a cloud-based session where they can check their mail, do their Google Docs or whatever else, jump onto Ubuntu One and not bother waiting the 30 or 40 seconds for Windows to boot up, then they'll do that. And gradually, it's a bit of a Trojan horse. Gradually, it will start to supplant Windows completely for those users that have got it on their machine.
A Trojan horse in a nice way.
Yes.
In a nice way.
A nice fluffy Trojan horse. Maybe a unicorn. A Trojan unicorn.
A Trojan. moving swiftly on, which we're not, another topic that Mark was talking about were changes to the various menus, such as the sound menu and the Mi menu, and what he's planning to do with the indicators. And I believe that's in the first segment of his UDS keynote. So rather than talk too much about that, I may well take that as the first chunk that we insert later on in this podcast.
Yeah, I think one of the scenarios he gave was quite interesting, being able to remotely control the volume of another machine. So, you know, that Pulse Audio has network capabilities, and being able to sit at my laptop and control the volume of, you know, my hi-fi or my media PC from my desktop, you know, just by sliding a thing in the indicator area. Sounds like quite a cool idea to me.
Mm. Although we don't tend to mention Pulse Audio too much around here, because that is Dave's nemesis.
Excellent, excellent.
It makes me sad.
And I think the other story that we got from that keynote was that Unity is going to have Chromium as its default web browser.
Yeah, that's cool. What browser do you lot use?
I've got Firefox and Chromium, and I frequently have them both running at the same time, and I skip between the two.
I use Firefox, and I'm a huge fan of it, so I'll be saddened when the day that Chromium will replace Firefox on the desktop edition.
Is it the extensions and that you miss?
No, I just really like Firefox. I can't see the benefit of using Chromium. It's okay, maybe a bit faster. The only benefit I see of using Chrome over Firefox would be for the each tab is a process, but that's coming in Firefox 4, so I can't see any benefit at all from switching.
The speed thing was quite interesting. Evan, who's one of the developers of Chromium, was at UDS, and he gave a demo, and he showed, and you can actually test this on your own machine, if you try and start GNOME Calculator, and he wasn't picking on GNOME Calculator, it was just an application he chose. If you start GNOME Calculator and then do an ampersand and then Google Chromium and start them both at the same time, effectively, is what that command line would do. Chrome starts before the calculator.
Right.
So, you know, the fact that your browser can open faster than the calculator application, and when you, and he also alt-tabbed between the two of them, and the browser redrew it felt instantaneous, but you could actually see the calculator draw all the buttons as he alt-tabbed between them quickly. Whether Chromium is faster or not, it feels faster, and I think that's the selling point. It feels faster.
Yeah, it is faster, but we're talking milliseconds when we're loading pages. Is it really that important?
I don't think it's just the loading pages. The alt tab experience.
Oh right, yes.
Is amazing when you're flicking between one application and another, and the whole. I mean, one. I did actually ask the guy Evan on the train on the way back because I noticed on my Windows PC at work when I load a page in Chrome, sometimes if I switch to it, it loads like a Sinclair Spectrum loading screen coming down the screen really, really slowly, one line at a time. And he said, yeah, that's what happens if the page gets swapped out of memory, because it actually has a bitmap for whatever you're looking at is a bitmap image held in memory. And that's how it does it so quickly. It doesn't redraw the screen. It just goes bam and puts a bitmap on the screen. So when you alt tab away and alt tab back, bam, bitmap, and it's super quick. So there are, yeah, I agree that, yeah, we don't want to kiss Firefox goodbye completely, but there's some compelling reasons to use Chrome.
It's not GTK, is it, Chromium, which would be a problem with the new indicators.
It actually draws the whole window itself, even on Windows.
Yeah.
When you run Chrome on Windows, the window controls in the top right, the wrong side, are completely fake. It paints those on.
All right.
They're not drawn by Windows itself. So it has all kinds of tricks to make it faster.
Yeah. It really depends on what you want to use your browser for. I mean, I've got half a dozen extensions in Firefox, and it is sometimes a bit of a tardy beast, and its startup time is not great. And it does entirely depend on what sites and what pages I'm wanting and how fast I want to flick around from one thing to another. I don't think there's any doubt. I was looking at a set of benchmarks this morning because I was started to do a Midori review, which is another lightweight browser, and I was trying to get some empirical figures on what's the comparative performance between Midori, Chromium, Conqueror and Firefox. And you know, everybody's benchmarks where they've actually put it through a software benchmark with some hard timings on it, Chromium keeps coming out faster. But that's not necessarily the first thing I'm going to go to, depending on what I want to do. I'm now synchronizing my bookmarks on Ubuntu One. I can do that in Firefox. I don't think Chromium's anywhere near doing that yet. So
yeah, not yet. But the good thing is, Chromium is open source, so the Mozilla Foundation can learn from the tricks that Chromium uses and make Firefox better, and equally, you know, Google can learn from the great stuff that Mozilla have done with Firefox and make Chromium better. So you could get extensions on Chromium to make that compelling, and you could get the speed enhancements on Firefox to make that compelling. So everyone wins.
Hey, the benefits of open source.
Mm.
Indeed.
Our last couple of stories. The boys over at OMG Ubuntu got their first episode of their podcast out, which is Ubuntu Tuesday.
You mean Ubuntu Tuesday?
Ubuntu Tuesday, yes.
I think they're regretting calling it that.
The podcast are people who don't like podcasts, apparently.
Yes, whoever they are.
There's plenty of room for plenty of podcasts in the Ubuntu community.
There
so
are.
This is all good.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be here.
Too true.
I listened to their first one, which in production terms was a bit rough around the edges, and I know exactly how that feels, but their content was good.
We're recording at UDS, weren't they? Or Ben...
That was the intention. I don't think it actually happened. I get it's unfortunate given that UDS was in Brussels, which is only 1 hour time difference from where Joey is, and so they could have recorded something there, but unfortunately UDS is so manic and so intense, I think it was a bit difficult for Benjamin to get, you know, a Skype connection.
Yeah.
So now Benjamin's back at home in New Zealand, and they're at least 12 hours apart, which makes it even harder. Plus they're using Skype, so you know, you've got that latency. And so good luck to them. They'll need it.
Yeah, Benjamin did say that he was struggling to get everything done at UDS that he wanted to, and he did grab a bit of video that I haven't actually sat down and watched yet, but it was a sort of a
it's good fun.
Put together a bit of a compilation. And finally,
Ubuntu made its second TV appearance last night on CBS on their TV show The Big Bang Theory, where Ubuntu was mentioned, and there's a video in the show notes for you all to watch.
Marvellous.
I've already seen it. It's been very impressive.
Yes.
It's one line.
That's one line.
It's been 8 seconds long, but...
Any publicity is good publicity.
Well, yeah. Rory Kethlen Jones mentioned Ubuntu.
Yes, BP might not agree with you at that stage.
Rory Kethlen Jones mentioned Ubuntu on BBC Breakfast once, and I took a transcript of everything he said and picked apart what he said and had a bit of a pop at him. And he replied, you know, thanks for transcribing everything I said, but also, you know, I've mentioned Ubuntu on mainstream, you know, national telly. Who else has done this kind of thing? And I kind of felt a bit bad. So
I saw that. Yes, I can't remember how long ago that was, but I saw that. Did you put that on the blog?
I did. Yeah.
Yes.
So yes, it is good that we get mainstream press and mainstream TV programs. You know,
the BBC did a good job of it because, well, Roy did a blog post where he spent 24 hours with Ubuntu. And then when 9.10 got released, they did an interview with one of the Canonical developers showing off what's new in 9.10, which was pretty good.
Yeah, the problem was, right, when he did the first one, where he did the 24 hours, for some reason Canonical saw fit to give him a broken laptop. Now, that's just stupid. And because Canonical don't have a big stack of laptops that they can give out to reporters running Ubuntu, they also didn't give him one that ran, that had all the you know, restricted stuff pre-installed, because out of the box, that's not what you get. And then what was the second one you mentioned?
The interview with one of the Canonical developers about 9.10.
The interview with Chris Kenyon was done in a basement where there was absolutely no Wi-Fi and no possibility for him to get online. So he couldn't show off all the cool online features. He just had to kind of poke around the desktop a bit. Mm. So it's unfortunate that the situations we appear online is being a sideline on BBC Breakfast when Windows 7 launched, or in a situation where we can't show off the best bits, or in America on a show that's predominantly watched by geeks. It's unfortunate.
It's had two mentions on the BBC Click programme in the last 18 months or so that I remember.
Yeah, Click, and I think The Gadget Show might have mentioned it at some point. But
They have.
Both of those programmes tend to focus on the free of cost element and don't focus on the fact that it is just better.
Yes, sadly.
It can be difficult for them to advise to the mainstream to use Ubuntu because they may feel responsible if it doesn't work because they've told their viewers that it's amazing.
Yes, people phoning up Channel 5, I can't get my Broadcom wireless to work.
Okay, have we got any more news or are we all newsed out?
Oh, is it? Can I throw one last thing?
Yes, please.
Mavericks releasing on 10.10.10.
Yes. That's Mark made a very big point on one of his slides about that. Mm. And go on, like explain the significance to those who haven't clicked with that yet.
So 10.10.10, 10.10.10.10.10 is 42 in decimal. If 10.10.10.10 were binary, 42 in decimal. 42, according to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, is the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. And quite a lot of geeks are into, or the kind of social circle of Ubuntu users are into Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Douglas Adams' kind of work. So, they're kind of, I quite like that.
As soon as that slide came up, I thought, that's a really, really good date to pick. Releasing 10.10 on the 10th of October 2010. How memorable is that?
It's brilliant.
No chance you can forget it. And then we disappeared off into Douglas Adams territory.
Yes. Well, there's both. Obviously, this puts pressure on the development team because it was scheduled to release at the end of October. Mm. So actually, that being pulled back, you know, it's and Robbie Williamson, who manages the release schedule, has given a presentation, which is also available online, that talks about how they've managed to juggle the schedule. And he's actually planned ahead for the next 2 years' schedule. Which is quite interesting.
Has it been confirmed then that we are going to go for the 10.10.10?
That's the plan. That's
right.
The plan.
Well, Mark's announced it in a slide with letters 2 foot high, so I should think, yes, they've been told that's when they're releasing.
I think there are a few Canonical people in the room that went, what?
and it's a Sunday.
Yes.
Because we've never gone early. We've always been late before with 6.06.
There's certainly an argument to pull it back from the end of the month, because at the moment it's, you know, the last one was April 29th, and if that was only a week late, then it wouldn't be 10:04, it'd be, you know, 10:05. So there's certainly an argument for pulling it back from the end of the month, but this is 10 is quite a long way back from the end of the month.
Mm. So when we said the other day that only 172 days to get it right, as it turns out, it's quite a bit less than that.
Mm. I'm sure they can do it.
I'm sure they will. If they,
it's going to be the best.
Carry on.
It's going to be the best Ubuntu yet, definitely. Can't be bad with that many factors working in this favour.
As long as they don't drop anything dramatic in, like another change of window buttons or anything at the 11th hour.
No idea what you're talking about.
It's 144 days, or 3,434 hours, 20 minutes and 32 seconds.
Stato.
Right.
Thank you, Ez.
You realise that's 10 seconds of your life you're never going to get back, having worked that out.
You've wasted 10 seconds of that time, eh?
Shall we get on with the show?
Yes.
Yeah, but anyway, speaking of those buttons being moved, it was difficult at first, but I've come to terms with it, and it's all fine, apart from with Google Chrome, where it's all in the wrong place.
No, it's not. But, you just go to the settings and change it to put the buttons on the left. Just click on the spanner.
Oh,
click.
There you go. Or I can just use the little X in the tabs, is what I do.
Just click the spanner, click Options, under the Personal Stuff tab, click Use GTK Theme, and it just moves the buttons to the left. Sorted.
Tip of the week, courtesy of Mr. Alan Pope. Now, please, can we get on with the show?
No! Let's talk more about UDS.
Full Circle Interview.
If you recall, in episode 5, we first spoke to Mr. Benjamin Humphrey of the Ubuntu Manual team about setting up the project and the aims and objectives in producing the Ubuntu Manual. In this second part, we went on to talk about the software tools that they're using. So, ladies and gentlemen, we present Mr. Benjamin Humphrey to talk about QuickShot and Latex, which is not the rubber part of his wardrobe, but the page layout tool. You alluded to QuickShot, which is your screenshot application, which is the custom application that I think you said was written in Python. Just set that one up for us, because I already know the answer to this question, having been through this process myself, but why did you need to write your own screenshot application?
Yeah, I've been asked this before. Why didn't we just make it a plugin for Shutter or something? That was an option, but I think we had like 5 weeks to write it from an idea, and I did the mock-ups and stuff with a pencil and paper, and then scanned them in. And we had 5 weeks to go from an idea into reality to be able to use it. And our original target was to use it in the Ubuntu Global Jam. It wasn't quite ready by then. The idea just started out as to be able to take screenshots in different languages, and then started getting a bit more complicated when we realized that we had to install language packs and stuff, and I just started the idea. The credit for QuickShot goes to other people, but the guys in the QuickShot team have done a fantastic job at making it usable in like 4 or 5 weeks, and they've made a live DVD, which basically has Ubuntu Lucid on it, QuickShot on it, and all of the language packs that come with Ubuntu. And you can download the image file, put it into your computer, reboot it, into the live DVD, and start up QuickShot, and you can take screenshots. It's all very automated, and QuickShot captures the correct portion of the screen, because not all of our screenshots are full screen. So if we're capturing just, say, the Firefox search bar, for example, it will already know the dimensions and the screen location, captures them all at the same resolution and the same file format, which is .png, and uploads them to our server. And they've added a whole bunch of automated stuff in, like it automatically launches Firefox when you choose that screenshot to take, automatically changes your screen resolution, it detects your graphic settings, it downloads a list of screenshots from the server, a whole bunch of cool stuff that they've done. And I think it's really neat. And so what we're very keen to do, and they're working on for the QuickShot 1.0 release, is to build in an easy preferences menu where you can select a different server for a different project. And The documentation team of a learning project who need to get course materials can easily use QuickShot to gather a whole bunch of screenshots in a short amount of time.
That impresses me. Having worked in brochure publishing and training, having a tool that automates a lot of that and supplies the consistency and makes things as easy as possible. I think you've just outlined the one thing that's likely to save yours and the team's sanity over the next few years.
Yeah. And it's not just stopped there. The guys have a whole etherpad full of ideas they want to take QuickShot in the next few months. And I think it's gone beyond just a plugin for like Shutter, because for us to work out how Shutter worked and then to develop a plugin for it that did everything that QuickShot does would take longer than if we were just to write it from scratch ourselves. So that's why we've decided to write it from scratch. We're actually using a fairly complicated system. So we're writing it in LaTeX, which isn't like the easiest way to make a book, compared to OpenOffice or something. 99% of people in the world have no idea what LaTeX is. We're also using Bazaar, Launchpad, there's QuickShot, there's all that sort of stuff. So we use a whole bunch of step-by-step instructions, easy buttons and stuff like that. We worked with Martin Owens, who developed Ground Control, to easily get... It's like for those who don't know what Ground Control is, it's a GUI front-end to BZR. It's just like a Python plugin for Nautilus, and it's really cool. And anyway, you can easily grab the branch, and Ground Control actually has a button so you can run custom commands when you have the branch, and so we did that to compile LaTeX and stuff. We have a script that installs LaTeX because we're using a newer version of LaTeX that's not available in the Ubuntu repository, so you have to actually download it from somewhere and set it up, and it's like a 2 or 3 gig download. So all of that sort of stuff, we've automated all with a script to make it as easy as possible. We hosted a big online event over 2 days a few weeks ago that we ran about 6 or 7 hour-long training sessions on for different roles, for editors, for authors, for people who want to help with artwork and what you need to do to get started. And that was quite cool because we got to test out Jono's Learned application and the Ubuntu Classroom guys, Nathan Handler and Chris Johnston, developed ClassBot, and we got to test that out for them as well. So overall, that was quite cool. The problem that I see with a lot of things in open source is people are really keen to get involved in projects, but they sort of don't know how. So if you've got a project that covers a wide range of things like ours does, and you've got someone who's particularly skilled in one area, it's quite hard for them to specifically get involved in that area. So what we've done is broken it down into, are you an author? Do you like developing web applications or something? Or do you know Python? And then we have, if you like Python, click this big button here and it takes you to another page which gives you a step-by-step instruction on how to get the QuickShot branch and to start working on that. Whereas other projects are just, this is our website. It's sort of buried away under all these things, and there's no any problems, contact us on IRC. We've got our own IRC channel. We've got our own mailing list. And that's sort of what we've focused on, and we're going to make it even easier as years go on. I've got an idea which is quite ambitious to create a graphical user interface for LaTeX, which will be a what you see is what you get editor. And
there is so much cutting edge thinking and technology coming out of this project that you could actually end up with something that's as big as Ubuntu itself at this rate.
It could be. So the idea I have, which is some of the people in our team think I'm crazy, is to basically have an application like OpenOffice, but very much simplified, and where, so LaTeX is just like plain text, but it has commands. So if you want to enter in like bold text, you just wrap it in a command, which is like /textbf. And we have a lot of our own custom commands for stuff like margin notes and for section headers and for different things like that that we have developed that are quite hard for people to learn in the first place because there's a hell of a lot of them. And so what we want to do is actually just have like a thing like OpenOffice where you just select your text and you click bold and it turns it bold, but behind the scenes it's actually entering that txbf command and wrapping it with colons or the brackets around it.
For those who don't know, LaTeX is a page layout program, which I think stems from the old-fashioned mainframe days before we even had any kind of graphical interface, desktop publishing style applications. Its roots are in very old-fashioned industrial style, but very precise page layout and printing, but without all the modern-day whiz-bangs that we all take for granted on the desktop.
Yeah, we were originally going to... The project started out as an open office document, which we realized was pretty bad for collaboration. And then and then we moved to DocBook. And we were with DocBook for a while, and I was trying to set up the DocBook thing, and I had no idea how to set it up. DocBook's quite complicated, actually, as I found out. And LaTeX is actually the... And then somebody came along called Kevin Godby, who's actually our lead, we call him lead technician with an X, and because LaTeX runs off a core programming language called Tex, and so he came along and he said, well, what about LaTeX? And he's doing a PhD in human computer interaction, and he's working basically full time on our project instead of writing his thesis, and. He came along and he was a fantastic help from day one, and he set up all of our LaTeX templates and stuff. We created our own book style, and LaTeX, once you get used to it, is actually pretty easy to use, a lot easier than DocBook, and that's why we use it. It's used all around the world in publishing firms and that sort of stuff, because it's renowned for its word wrapping algorithms and stuff like that, and it also has an incredibly large font and special character support, which is what we need for all of our translations.
Sure.
I mean, when you're trying to do like right to left Arabic or something, then you can't just use OpenOffice. You need to have something really intense, which is why we're using LaTeX.
The Full Circle podcast is the companion to Full Circle magazine, the independent magazine for the Ubuntu community. Find us at fullcirclemagazine.org/podcast.
Full Circle Guest Spot.
So for our next segment, we were planning, before anybody talks any more about UDS or window buttons or pulse audio breaking, we were going to talk about...
It's not broken this week, it's fine.
We are going to talk about the bug reporting process.
Uh-oh.
Which is where Mr. Pope is going to sing for his supper, and it's as well that we haven't got Ed and Alan in the same room at the same time, because I believe when we were talking about bug reporting last time, Alan, you were doing a fair amount of shouting at the PC.
So, Ed, what was the problem you had?
Well, my problem was that I posted the issue that when you started up Lucid, that they wouldn't detect the correct monitor resolution. And I thought I did a fairly good bug report, but without log files, which is always not the best idea, and expected someone to really come up with an idea of how to solve it. And then I complained that no one was helping me how to get these log files onto the bug report because I had no graphical user interface. When I did finally get the log files to work or onto a bug report, no one wanted to read through them and work out what the problem was, and that where it kind of went off from there.
So you were getting frustrated. So I feel like an agony aunt now. So lay down.
How did that make you feel, Ed?
Over to Dr. Allen.
Okay, so you had a problem with your screen resolution not being detected. You've got an NVIDIA card, yes?
Yes.
And how did you go about finding the bug?
Because, well, usually I will use Ubuntu-bug and then type in the process name if I've got a graphical user interface. But because I had no graphical user interface, I just went onto Launchpad and just started a bug with no information other than what has happened to me by just filling out the description on the bug report.
Right. And you got a reply from someone that said, we need more information, you know.
Put some log files in, yes. Or right. Some configuration files.
This was obviously a graphical problem, so you couldn't get a GUI up, and so you couldn't press buttons to be able to, you know, get those kind of log files. Is that the problem?
Yes.
Okay. The good thing is, you can actually get those kind of log files without a GUI, but clearly it's not obvious how you do that. So the kind of log files that you would need, you don't really need to know what they are, but they're squirreled around in /var/log/something, and you can in fact get those directly from the command line. Now the problem is if you're a new user, I'm not saying you are, but if you're a new user and you don't have that knowledge, then that can be a bit of a problem. If someone's giving you the go and find me log files and you don't know how to do that, then I guess the first thing would be ask how you get those log files. Because, personally, I know how to get them, but your average user, like, I refer back to my mum, she would have no clue how to get a log file. In fact, I don't think she even knows what a bug is, let alone reporting a bug and gathering that kind of information. So my first point would be get back in contact with whoever has responded. A lot of the time on a bug report, because we have so many bugs, the person who replies isn't necessarily going to be the person who works on the bug. There's a team of people who triage bugs, and these are not necessarily developers. They're people who are just looking at bugs and saying, well, is this really a bug, or is it working as designed, or is it actually a bug but you've picked the wrong package, or is it a bug and I need more information? And the triagers will figure that kind of stuff out. So chances are the first port of call you hit was a bug triager. And one of the weapons in their arsenal in order to work through this humongous amount of bugs we have is that they copy and paste chunks of text into the bug. And so they might have copied and pasted a chunk of text into the bug that says, please give us more information. And it might have come across perhaps as a little bit unfriendly. Is that probably what happened?
I can give you the bug report now. I found the number.
Oh, good. While I was waffling away, you got the number.
529-387.
Screen goes out of range. Wow, that's a big bug report.
Yeah, I must have gone back into Karmic and typed in Ubuntu bug and then the process, because since it was using the same screen, I would have assumed it would give me the same sort of files which I would need to report the bug, but it didn't, as Bruce Harrington suggested.
Okay, so if you read through that bug, so the bug number is 529-387, and people can read along with us. You gave a nice chunky amount of text there describing what the problem is, and it apport, which is the program that added all those useful logs, added them directly to the bug as a bunch of attachments. And your first response was 3 days later from Bryce Harrington, who is was the Xorg maintainer for Canonical, and he confirmed the bug. And you added some more information 2 weeks later, and then he asked you to run something to gather more information, and you said you're not able to get to your computer, but you'll try it out a week later. So actually, this looks like a model bug report. You're providing, exactly the kind of information people want, lots of detail.
Well, in the past, I thought I was fairly good at bug reports, just using the tool, which is brilliant, Apport, because it does everything for you. So that's one of the great things about bug reporting, I think, is that tool.
And you've got all the right people looking at this. Bryce Harrington, who's the Xorg maintainer, and Jeremy Foshi, who is a great singer and also a bug triager for the kernel. And he sends you an automated message. Okay. So really, what's your problem?
It wasn't getting fixed fast enough. I just didn't feel people were helping, because I only provided those log files after I figured out how to do it. I felt that no one was doing enough to try and get this stable before release day.
I don't see anything wrong with your bug report. It's just your frustration that it's not being fixed quick enough.
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah, not much we can do about that.
So, Alan, in sort of a nutshell, is there any way you would describe what someone should do when they want to make the ideal bug report?
Thank you, Dave. I was going to ask that very question.
Sorry. I stole your thunder there. So you can ask it.
Yeah, you can cut the last half hour and just get down to David's question. Yeah, one of the key things is providing detail. There are, in fact, a number of wiki pages that outline the kind of information that a developer needs in order to figure out what's wrong with the system. Now, but before you get to that, you've obviously got to figure out if it really is a bug or not. Giving a nice descriptive text, I did this, I expected these things to happen, but in fact, this happened, where that might mean, I expected some graphics to appear on my screen and I got a black screen. or it might be, you know, my machine crashed or whatever. So giving a nice detailed description is always a good thing. I'll give you some links to pages on the wiki. It's actually easy to remember. It's just wiki.ubuntu.com/bugs. And there's a couple of nice big buttons at the top that tell you how to report a bug. And one of the key things about reporting bugs is not just providing detail, but also providing the right detail. So, for example, something might be a bug in the X windowing system. It might be a bug in the application you're using, or it might be a bug in the kernel. But the thing is, you don't necessarily know that. Now, once you've been using Ubuntu for a while, you might know that. You might have some kind of clue whether it's a graphical glitch, and that might be X, or it might be the application itself crashing, and that might be the application. But it might also be something else, completely unrelated, you might think unrelated. And so it's worth providing as much information as you can and following the guides that are on wiki.ubuntu.com/bugs and providing detail, as much detail as you can, really.
I'm looking at another of the wiki pages. Well, it's actually help.ubuntu.com/community/reporting bugs, which has a description of the bug reporting process on it, which people might find of some use. One of the things that it says right at the top, not surprisingly, Ubuntu uses Launchpad to keep track of bugs and their fixes. To file a bug, you first need to create an account.
Mm.
My first question is, is there any way of reporting a bug without a Launchpad account?
Get someone else to do it.
Yeah. So that won't be your mum then?
Well, yes, it would. My mum would get me to file a bug. Really, you need an account. And it's not that hard. I mean, if people can sign up to Amazon.co.uk, they can sign up to Launchpad. And if they can sign up to eBuyer, you can sign up to Launchpad. So it's not that hard to sign up to Launchpad. It's probably harder to try and articulate the problem that you're experiencing and detail exactly what you were doing up to and including the point at which the thing happened, program crashed or whatever, it's a lot harder to do that than it is to sign up to Launchpad. Whilst it's a bit of a pain that you have to sign up for something, compare that with the Windows way of doing things, where a box pops up in the middle of the screen and says, this thing crashed, tell Microsoft, and you click a button and it disappears into the void, and you never know whether that's ever going to be fixed or if anyone's even going to look at it. At least with this, you get the opportunity to talk to the people who look after the code that you're running.
So I suppose you could say, in a typical sort of Ubuntu-themed way, it adds an extra human element.
Very good.
You could say that. I wouldn't, but you could.
it
does add a bit of a stumbling block, but to be honest, you kind of need that. You need to have at least a small stumbling block for people to get over before they actually report a bug. Because if you just had an open access thing that let anyone file bugs about anything, you would get even more crazy comments and bugs than we already have. It's already easy enough. If we made it too easy, then we'd get all kinds of stuff where people are just saying, this thing crashed and I don't know why. And that would be it. No detail, no idea how to help them. So I don't think it's unreasonable asking for an account.
Okay, so the next thing after that is managing expectations, because Ed was getting frustrated that it was a countdown to release time for the for the new release, and it didn't look like anything was happening. First stage with new bug reports is that they go into a triage team, correct?
Well, initially a bug is new. It has a status of new, which means that basically nobody's looked at it. Or people might have looked at it, but they've not done anything with it. Once it's been triaged, ideally someone will have left a comment, a reply of some kind to say, we need more detail. We can't pass, the developers, you know, aren't interested in this until we've got some more detail about what the problem is. Now, it might be that it's a major catastrophic bug and a bazillion people are filing the same thing at the same time, and in which case the bug triagers will notice that pretty quickly, because they'll see lots of similar bugs appearing, and they'll also see lots of people replying to the same bug. And you'll also notice at the very top of every single bug report, it says this bug affects, and then a number, person. Does this bug affect you? And you can click a little button to say, yes, it affects me. And so that gives the developers and the triagers some kind of idea of how many people are affected. Now, your bug, Ed, let's just scroll up to that one, says this bug affects one person. and you are the only subscriber to that bug. Now, if I was taking a completely objective look at that bug, I would say that's not a catastrophic bug. Because whilst it's annoying and frustrating for you, there isn't a bazillion people who are looking at that going, oh my God, when is this bug going to be fixed? And we do get celebrity bug reports that, you know, have oodles of people replying saying, this is broken, this needs to be fixed now, and this kind of stuff, which isn't necessarily helpful, but it gives us some kind of gauge that it's actually affecting a large number of people. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, yes. I see where you're coming from with, is it important to getting this fixed quickly than it can be fixed, you know, soon?
Yeah, the good thing is after a version of Ubuntu is released, we have a thing called SRU, stable release updates. So once a release has gone out the door, we can still put updates into it through the repository. Now that does mean that the CD is broken, you know, in some way, and we have to get people to update their system in order to fix it. But we do actually issue new CDs in a few months' time, and then a few months after that, because it's an LTS release. So for a bug report that is, you know, one guy is being affected by something, can probably work around it, maybe use a different driver or, you know, some kind of other workaround. It's not a catastrophe. It's frustrating for the user, I'm sure.
In my list of subscribed bugs, I have a lot of bugs which relate to Jaunty and Intrepid. Do the developers ever clear up the old bugs, Chuck?
Yes.
When?
Well, triage a scan. I mean, do you think you could actually clear up your old bugs? If there's a bug that you think is no longer valid or no longer appropriate, or you think there's no point looking at it because clearly nobody else is experiencing that bug, then you can mark it as invalid, and yep, then nobody will look at it.
Okay,
right. That's probably the easiest thing to do if you want to clear up your bugs, is just go through each one and just tag them as invalid, and then if they're ones you've reported, mark them as invalid.
Okay, sorted.
Very good. Are we done on the bug reporting front?
Yes, I am.
Good.
So we're all experts on bugs now, then.
Can I mention another useful thing that the bug people are doing? The kernel developers are creating a system that lets you create a live USB stick or CD and put that into a machine, and it gathers information about that machine and then reports that back to Launchpad. And if you're not online because maybe the network card is the thing that doesn't work on that machine, then it will record that information on the USB stick. And then you can take that to another machine that is online and send that information to Launchpad. So it's a great way of, for example, a meeting where you've got a whole bunch of PCs, you could go around and stick the USB stick into every single one of them, boot off it, gather the information, and then submit that online to just tell them which machines worked, which didn't, and that would be useful information for them.
Indeed it would.
It's not ready yet. It's not ready yet, but when it is, I'm sure you'll be told.
Very good. So, gentlemen, shall we do the game section?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, sure, why not?
We sound so enthusiastic.
Full Circle Gaming.
A few things have broken in the latest version of Ubuntu, especially with regard to games. But unfortunately, the humble indie bundle has kept me occupied for the past couple of weeks, so I haven't really noticed. But the Game Boy emulator doesn't work so well anymore, and a lot of things that used to work perfectly in Wine suddenly, well, they still work, but certain features in them don't work. So the game has just broken on the inside for some reason.
So you bought the humble indie bundle?
I did, yes.
And so did Ed.
Can I ask you, is it rude to ask how much you paid?
I saw what the average was, and I started to go for... I converted the amount into pounds, so just changed the sign, and then went £5 over it. So, I mean, it wasn't as much as it would have cost, so I paid £20 for it. I thought that was fair.
Yeah, I paid about the same, actually, yeah.
Yeah, totally good.
But I didn't do any kind of... I didn't do any kind of calculation as you did. I just thought 20 quid sounded about right.
Yeah. Wow. Who's that utilitarian philosopher who calculated it, who decided to design an actual unit for pleasure? And a bit like that. I was paying that unit in pounds.
the world of goo unit of pleasure.
Indeed. The World of Goo was amazing. I loved it. It made a weekend of mine completely disappear. But it was very, very imaginative.
There's another game that I bought just today, actually, called Osmos.
Ah,
I don't know if you've seen Osmos. That. Yes.
Dave, wasn't that the one that you were going to talk about, Dave? Or was that one that Ed was talking about?
The one that Ed was talking about, I imagine.
It's $10, which is £7.14 at the current exchange rate. And I think that's a super amount of money to spend on a game. And it's, again, another one of these all three platforms, Windows, Linux, Mac. Mm. I'll give you the link.
I can see it now, and I'm looking at it.
Very good.
Oh, yes! Oh, no, we were talking about it. That was Ed talking about that last week, and I compared it to Katamari Damacy, or something like that.
Yes, as only you would.
Yeah, as apparently only I would, since no one else seems to have heard of it. I think it was only released.
I did go and look up that other one that you were talking about, and it is fairly well established, and there is quite a lot of people who have heard of it. So
it's not within the Linux community.
That's fair comment.
I was playing Aquaria as well lately, and I found that to be incredibly difficult. I mean, really, really hard. A lot of these indie games tend to be hard, but I mean, what's it called? World of Goo wasn't hard. It was just imaginative and very intellectually challenging rather than anything else. I'm rambling again, sorry.
Well, it's the closest we've had to intelligible segment so far.
Oh, that's really good.
While Ed was offline. Ed, do you want to talk about that one?
Yes, there's a great deal which was going on a few weeks ago. Basically, a developer called Wolfire created a bundle of 5 indie games which are all supported on Mac, Windows and Linux. World of Goo, Aquaria, Gish, Lugrara, how do you pronounce that? A bunny rabbit fighting game, and Abrundra Overture is a collection of games which are come to a value of $80, but you can have them for whatever you want to pay for them. So you can pay as little as 1 cent, which is criminal, or the top payment was £33,333.33. It was
good deal, I think. Good deal.
I decided to donate $30, which I thought was reasonable, and the games are all fantastic. Going into the bundle, I only knew about one game, which was World of Goo, which I'd reviewed before and played and absolutely loved, and it was well worth. It's on its own. It's well worth the $80. And the other 4 games are brilliant. They're very good games. But I will be doing a review of the other 4 in the next 4 issues of the Full Circle magazine. And so we also provided some interesting stats to the bundle. And basically, the amount of money they raised was almost $1.3 million. There was almost 140,000 contributors, and the average donation was $9.17. Now, this is when it gets very interesting. The total revenue per platform was $8 on Windows, $10 on Mac OS X, and the total revenue per platform, on Windows it was $8, on Mac OS X it was $10, and on Linux it was almost $15. And then when you go down to splitting each platform up to most sales, Windows is obviously first, but Linux is second, with Mac OS X third. So it really shows to other developers that Linux is a platform willing to pay more money, as well as there is more others wanting to play games.
That's amazing. So it actually proves that Linux is actually a better platform for games than Mac.
Yes, on this such sale. And when World of Goo did a similar sale where you paid $41 for World of Goo, they found the same thing, that Linux were willing to pay more money for the game, and there was more of us buying the game than OS X users. So here,
pretty much idiotic to make anything for Mac, which we already knew.
Yeah. it is slightly annoying that you see, you know, 2 examples of Linux users out in force buying games. But yeah, we're still not we're not really any closer at getting the big developers on board. But it was a great bundle. I'm really happy I've paid the money I did, $30, to get some 5 excellent games, which are now 4 of them have gone open source, which is even better.
It was definitely worth it. There were some enjoyable games in there. Well, I mean, I loved World of Goo. It was just Crazy awesome. Aquaria was beautiful. Yep. Gish, I haven't really played Gish that much.
No, say not.
Lugaru I found to be really, really hard.
It is hard, but it's really enjoyable. I think the fighting mechanics of it is very excellent.
Yeah, the mechanics are damn good. The controls are really, really natural. And Penumbra, I mean, I love horror games, but the fact is, I just found it, the atmosphere is so powerful that it's been a difficult game for me to play. So I'll probably get around to it eventually when my nerves are a bit stronger. But it looks incredibly promising. It looks like a game that will actually terrify me. So.
Yeah. When I was playing, I was thinking that you would enjoy the story behind it, because there seems to be a lot of story and articles you could read while in the game, because there's books and letters you can pick up, which seemed really good for the story aspect of the game. And plus, you could also, some of the money which you donated went to charity as well. It went to the Child's Play Charity and Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is all very good.
Wormux is another one of those games designed for that crude group of people who just can't seem to manage to leave Windows gaming behind them as they step into the new and glorious world of Linux. As that describes me pretty much through and through, it seemed from the outset to be right up my street. Wormux is a thinly veiled clone, or rather, spiritual successor to the old Windows classic Worms, that in this case has become so thin that it's starting to resemble a net curtain the moths have been at. It looks like I'm not the only one to have noticed this, though, and I'm going to guess that the Wormux team have been on the receiving end of a number of letters from angry patent holders over the past few months, as a website still makes reference to a number of weapons that are exactly the same as those from Worms, and that have since been replaced by their Linux equivalent, by means of something that resembles a cardboard cutout of one of the various mascots, being seemingly glued to the side of the offending object in an effort to conceal it through cunning magician-like sleight of hand from the unsuspecting viewer. Well, I'm on to you, Wormux. Don't you think I'm not. The gameplay is much the same as the Windows game. There are up to 4 teams, controlled by either a player or the computer, and the object of the game is to destroy all members of the opposing teams. To help you towards your goal, you have various weird and wonderful weapons available to you, such as Super Tux, the Disco Grenade, and the Polecat Launcher. If you haven't played the original, you have to take my word for it that these were a lot more wacky the first time around, and copywriting issues were led to changes that made things rather more difficult to understand. Could anybody reasonably guess what a Polecat launcher might do? As a skunk, it was certainly much easier to understand. Aside from the already mentioned optimistically dogmatic insertion of various Linux and open source mascots, however, not much has changed. Play is still turn-based on the same varied 2D battlefields with destructible terrain, and grenades are still just as difficult to control. The big problem, however, is the AI. When I started playing, the only option was to play against a human player, with a hidden feature existing to play against a really stupid AI if you really wanted to, say to mix up battles with your friends a little bit. Since then, however, a proper AI has been implemented, and I have to say that so far it has not greatly surpassed its older brother in the special school. I can only assume that it's a model of the AI that used some sort of heavily crippled super soldier from the battlefields of the future, in which bullets and rockets are propelled by wind power instead of gunpowder, presumably in some sort of overzealous effort to solve the energy crisis and prevent climate change. The enemy players will never move, ever, going so far as to attempt to carve small mines in the terrain in an effort to get to you, when the same goal could easily be achieved by, say, taking 10 paces to their right, and something as simple as a wind blowing in the wrong direction can lead to them launching bazookas into their own faces. They do, however, possess the godly gift of aim and are able to throw a grenade from one side of the battlefield to the other and have it explode precisely when it connects with the target, when I struggle to even hit a single enemy in the battlefield littered with them, even when they're right next to me. It does seem like the programmers noticed this would be a problem and introduced measures to prevent it. However, these measures seem to consist of a certain probability existing for the AI to act like a complete idiot on its turn. And this is very obvious when it happens, as it will suddenly switch from being Apollo the Far Shooter to some clown who deliberately blows up his own people or shoots himself in the face. I suppose it evens the playing field a bit, but I always get the sense, almost like the AI is mocking me. Ho ho, you're so stupid. I can even shoot myself in the face and still win. And believe me, it could. Well, that's pretty much all I can say about Wormux. It's a great game and loads of fun, so long as you don't expect too much of the AI and you're forgiving of ripping off other franchises. It also seems to be developing quite rapidly at the moment, so I'm guessing the problems at this stage are likely to rapidly disappear sometime in the near future.
Contribute. The Full Circle podcast, like the magazine, is nothing without the contributions of the Ubuntu community. If you want to join us, want to suggest ideas for news, opinions, reviews, Creative Commons music tracks, or just want to give us a pat on the back, contact us at podcast@fullcirclemagazine.org.
Full Circle Guest Spot.
And so, keeping on the theme of the Ubuntu Developer Summit, we bring you part one of the keynote speech, which was delivered by Mark Shuttleworth, founder of the Canonical Company, in which he describes Ubuntu Lite and the new Unity interface.
Big round of applause for Mark Shuttleworth.
So, 10.04 LTS. What an unbelievable release. I get goosebumps thinking about it. It was an astonishing effort from an enormous number of people with a singular vision, and the result was itself singular. So I think you all deserve a huge round of applause. Thank you very much. Today, we start the process of honing down and focusing on what is going to go into the next release. The Maverick Meerkat is going to be a punchy release. Maverick is all about laying the foundations for 12.04 LTS, for embracing new technologies, and for moving really, really fast. We are facing a really fundamental and really important transition, a transition that every sort of technology platform or technology community or company or project or product goes through. And many of you may be familiar with this picture, but what's going on is this is how people become comfortable with something new in technology, right? You start out, if you have a clear idea, a clear vision of a better way to do something, you start out by attracting people who are attracted to that idea, who get it, who are insightful, right? We came out several years ago with some clear, powerful ideas about what free software could be on the desktop and in the broader ecosystem, how it could be delivered, 6-month releases, on time, updates, cadence, quality. And those ideas were a rallying call for a small, hardcore of people who were excited about what that could mean, who had vision, who had insight into what that could mean. Right? You run along for a while, growing in that community, and then you have to make a transition. It's called the chasm. And essentially, on the other side of that chasm, you have people who are not intrinsically enthusiastic about what you're doing. They will adopt your stuff if it suits their needs. And so you have to do a whole bunch of things differently if you want to win them over. And the really tricky thing is you have to do things differently to win these guys over without losing your core audience. Right? So, who are these guys? What binds them together? What do they have in common? Well, today, they are our incredible community, right? This is a crowd that is problem-solving, that sees a bug as a puzzle, that's innovative, that's engaged, that wants to use our platform to do other brilliant leading-edge types of things. Passionate, articulate, they will go out and tell people about Ubuntu, tell people about free software. They're brilliant, they're forgiving. Other side of that chasm, it's a different story, right? On the other side of the chasm, people are far less forgiving of a platform or a product which doesn't do things that they think are particularly obvious, doesn't do things that they think should be easy to do or that they expect are easy to do. They don't see a bug as a problem. So we're facing this now. This is an enormous challenge for us, but it is also a huge opportunity. If we can cross that chasm, if we can start to make Ubuntu something which is out of the box, without doubt, something that the average person who isn't focused on using a computer and what they can do with a computer is delighted by, then you will see Ubuntu and free software with it take off. So for me, this is an enormous opportunity for Ubuntu, but also for the broader free software ecosystem. There are a couple of free software projects that have made this leap: Firefox, to a certain extent, OpenOffice. But if Ubuntu can make that leap, and we are ready to make that leap, then all of the free software projects that are essentially are highlighted and promoted and visible in Ubuntu or immediately accessible to people who are running Ubuntu will have a hotline to those consumers, will have the opportunity to make their case, will have the opportunity to stand up and show what they can do for that audience. So there's some things we have to get right. Many of the people in this new audience will not install Ubuntu for themselves. They'll get it pre-installed. So we really need to think about what the experience is like when somebody receives a machine that has Ubuntu installed and opens it up and runs it for the first time. What happens for them? These are the things that we stand for. Freedom, collaboration, precision, reliability. Those are the things that people associate with us. Those are the things that we have to continue to stand for because that's what gets those early adopters on our side. But let's not be content anymore with those early adopters. Let's go after the whole market, right? We want to get to a position where Ubuntu could be installed on every single computer that the PC industry ships. Now, obviously, at the moment, Ubuntu, Windows, it's an either-or proposition, right? So what we want to do is we set out to make it possible for OEMs, to make it reasonable, to make it exciting for OEMs to install Ubuntu on the same machine that Windows is installed on, as a dual boot option, right? Focused on getting to the web really fast. Some of you will have seen kind of instant on offerings. We did a bunch of research around those. And we figured out that it's not about instant on. It's not about how fast you can look like you can do something. It's all about how fast you can actually deliver the web. And so we've set out to produce a version of Ubuntu which delivers the web in 7 seconds on a solid state disk. And that version of Ubuntu is available today to OEMs. It has no secret sauce in it. It is Ubuntu, as you know and love it, stripped down and focused on that singular task, custom builds for the specific machines concerned. The goal is the fastest possible connection to the web. With all of the network layers in place, the browser up and running, you are actually ready to go. In setting out to do this, we realized that it wouldn't be optimal to take the traditional desktop and just deliver that. That in these environments, in these almost stateless environments, there's some things that we don't have to worry about, and there's some things that we can afford to do a little bit differently. There's some new things that we need to, some constraints that we need to bear in mind. One of those constraints is that there's no traditional file management. In an instant-on environment, you're in an airport, you literally want to get on, get to the web, and be done. In fact, if there's file management there, you really want to think about it as a synchronization effort with the Windows partition, potentially, with the cloud, with other devices. So there's an opportunity to really change the way file management happens. There's also a really small set of applications, right? We're stripping down Ubuntu to the heart of the goodness. We're distilling it. It's still Ubuntu. You can still apt-get anything. You will be able to go from Ubuntu Lite to any version of Ubuntu, right? Or Kubuntu, or any other derivative of Ubuntu, right? This is a seed which will be planted on as many computers as we can arrange for it to be planted that can grow based on our merits, right? We get the opportunity to compete based on our merits. But initially, there's a very small set of applications. And then the third thing that we really identified is that the future is a touch-driven future. So we wanted to make sure that whatever we did here, it would work on devices where your finger was your obvious way of launching an application, switching between applications. So the result of all of that work looks a little different. That's Ubuntu Lite. Some things will be familiar, right? The indicators work that we've been pushing over the last year or so continues in Ubuntu Lite. But we've changed the way you launch applications. We've changed the way you see what's running. We've created a new launcher, and we've created a new panel, and they are Unity. A new netbook-oriented shell optimized for netbook environments where screen real estate is the critical issue. We're using Unity in Ubuntu Lite for the very first time because in creating it, we essentially addressed the problems that we needed for the instant web environment. We designed a launcher which works well with relatively few applications. We didn't need file management, so there's no traditional file management capability in here. We needed a panel that supported the indicators, but we wanted it to launch really fast. So today, you can download from a PPA, Unity. It is published under GPLv3. The source code is live now. After you add that PPA and apt-get Unity, you'll have a Unity login session at GDM. And when you log in, you'll be experiencing effectively Ubuntu Lite, but with your applications installed. Unity uses Clutter and Mutter, so it is aligned with GNOME 3. It uses many of the technologies that are emerging for dynamic displays and media-rich displays. At the moment, it includes the panel, which supports IATA indicators, and the launcher, which has a capability called the quick menu and supports a reveal. So the goal for the next cycle is for us to make Unity suitable for the interface of our netbook edition. Remember, it was designed for small screens because most of the computers that we're actually shipping on, most of the computers that will ship as with Ubuntu Lite, are running small screens. So our goal is to be able to get it to be the right interface for UNE. There are a couple of problems that we need to address. There are things that need to be designed and developed. And those will be the focus of the design discussions here at UDS and the netbook discussions here at UDS this week. So the first problem we have to solve is file management. We have to make it possible to actually use Unity in an environment where you really do care about having lots of local content and lots of attached storage, which is not the use case that we originally set out for Unity with Ubuntu Lite. And we have to deal with the case we have more applications. You saw that launcher is very generous in terms of the icon sizes. The reason for that is to make it touch-friendly, but of course that then limits the number of icons that you can get onto it in a small screen, so there are a number of design challenges to resolve in association with that. The lead designer, David Siegel, do you want to stand up and so folks know who you are? David Siegel. David will be leading conversations here at UDS about how we solve those problems, how we get Unity to be the perfect environment for Ubuntu Netbook Edition. And the engineering team involved, led by Neil Patel, but why don't you all stand up? Neil Patel leading. One consequence of us pushing for Unity on the Netbook Edition is that we will not have SysTray support in the Netbook Edition in 10.10. And that precipitates a change in the connection technologies used, so we are likely to use Connection Manager on the Netbook Edition in 10.10. It's a very substantial fundamental shift, and so here's a call to all of you for testing in that regard. This is the proposed design of the Dash. Essentially, it is a full-screen experience. So again, for small screens, we take it to the full screen. It's inspired by consoles. It's inspired by devices. And it plugs into a lot of the goodness that we think Zeitgeist is capable of. It plugs into a lot of the goodness that we think the hardware is capable of today. This is the focus of the design, getting this absolutely right. David, some of you may know David as the vision and inspiration of GNOME Do. And so he has taken on the challenge of making this as intuitive and as lightweight and as fast as GNOME Do, which is very popular for all of those characteristics. So some obvious questions that will come up. This is great for GNOME. GNOME now has a shell environment which is optimized for the netbook market. That is and continues to be an important marketplace. Unity is aligned with many of the technologies in GNOME Shell. We see GNOME Shell as being more appropriate and designed for, in all of the design conversations, for large screen environments where you have a more expansive approach, longer sessions where you are organizing activities and so on. We will be packaging GNOME Shell in 10.10, but the schedule of GNOME Shell's release and our release don't allow for GNOME Shell to be a default environment for us. That's a question that has come up many times. But it will be there, it will be in universe. I would encourage as many people as possible to run it so that we can provide, so that we can collaborate with the GNOME Shell folks And there are daily builds of GNOME Shell, so as Upstream works on that, you can get the very latest versions there. We will also continue to publish the GNOME Stracciatella session, which may or may not adopt elements of GNOME 3. So a very substantial project in Unity, a very substantial shift in Unity, and a broadening of the user experience options for GNOME users. The trajectory of that is about an 18-month trajectory. Our goal is to get Unity absolutely nailed down for 1204 LTS. There are many pieces that need to move quickly during that time, but we do expect that we can do it in that time frame. At which point, I hope that freedesktop.org and GNOME will have embraced all of these elements as they stabilize, as they crystallize, as they get completely nailed down.
Feedback. You can post comments and feedback on the podcast page at fullcirclemagazine.org/podcast. Send us a comment to podcast@fullcirclemagazine.org. You can also send us a comment by recording an audio clip of no more than 30 seconds and sending it to the same address. Comments and audio may be edited for length. Please remember, this is a family-friendly show.
Unless you want to stay around for the end of the shambles, then, Alan, we'll let you go.
I'll just listen in. I'll mute my mic and I'll just listen in because it's quite...
we're more entertaining than several repeats of CSI and whatever's on question time. Oh, no, wrong day.
Thank you, chaps. Sorry
Thank
if I...
Thank you very much, Alan. No, no, it's
fine. Oh, it's my pleasure.
If you want help editing, just let me know and I'll...
We'll see how we get on. Thank
Cheerio,
you.
Cheerio, chaps.
Cheers.
And there he was, gone. Mr. Alan Pope. From Ubuntu UK podcast. That was episode 7 of the Full Circle podcast with our special guest, Mr. Alan Pope, who helped us out on the topic of reporting bugs in Ubuntu and gave us some valuable insights into UDS and a couple of other things as well, including a bit of extra input into our game section. So we're going to wrap up now. We'll include some more interviews and some more of Mark's UDS keynote speech in the next episode. So for the time being... It's goodbye from Ed.
Bye. Sorry, I've lost the will to live now.
Sounding like a suicide note. So it's goodbye from Ed.
Yes.
Bye. Yes, it is.
Okay. And it's goodbye from Mr. Dave Wilkins.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Robin Catling. Goodbye. So we might, depending on when we do the next recording, we might just miss that one.
1 minute. Sorry, 1 minute.
God.
It's not normally this bad, honestly.
Whose idea was it to do this in the evening? I don't know.
Yeah, my computer's getting all tired now.
Sorry. I was getting shouts from my family that Apprentice is on.
Ah, okay.
Well, you better go up and watch it then.
Don't let us hold
you
up.
You might wait for an hour.
There's a brilliant thing that got invented. It's called the Betamax video recorder.
This is going to be an edit nightmare, isn't it?
Oh, you've just realised that.
It's better than normal, actually. It's going through all right.
It's going to be one of those days, isn't it?
One of those very long, painful...
It already has been. I was supposed to be doing some research today. I took a day off revision for my last big burst of exams next week. And what did they shut up the entire...
The entire...
Oh, dear.
That was just irony. They shut off the entire... ..
It's flashing me messages saying, what's happened?
Oh, God!
The most important thing I wanted to say is...
I'm going to
Especially, he can obviously hear us, because otherwise he'd have hung up by now. Unless he just thinks we're all sitting in silence, and sort of, but that's a 5-minute meditation you have occasionally in the middle of the episode.
Right, first thing tomorrow, there's going to be a new post on the Full Circle forum, Situations Vacant, Editor or Podcast.
Oh my god. Oh, hello, cameras, come on. Hello, what's going on
who's,
there?
Whose idea was this?
Well, indeed. How do I turn that off? Seriously, the button for camera has disappeared.
Oh, boy. I love it. This seemed like a good idea a few months ago. Let's see if we can get the boys back. Well, this could be the first 9-hour podcast recording we've ever had. The editing on this is just going to be beyond nightmare. This is now Freddy Krueger territory.
Mm. I mean, ours is quite bad. But
see, now you're at it, Ed.
It's bad boy.
It's all just falling to pieces. Even Alan's had enough of the joke and gone away. Seriously, chaps, we're up to 59 minutes on this, plus the stuff that we'd already got, and you guys aren't getting any better.
No.
I'm assuming that you can all hear me perfectly fine.
You've been excellent for every single episode. I don't know how you do it.
It's just my natural professionalism, darling.